disclaimer, yeah. Ooh, 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 oh. The views and opinions you hear as part of the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. You know you will, baby.
You're listening to Ancast, counting all the best to the 80s, 90s, and now. Welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. This is a special show. We've got the first in a series this year. We're going to be counting down top 10 of the best of each decade for the 80s, 90s, and the aughts. And obviously, this is our 80s show. So welcome to the 80s show. I am wearing my tricolor sweatband and moon boots or whatever. Joining us for this this momentous occasion, first, obviously, Justin Savakis is here. Hey, Justin.
I am dressed like David Bowie.
Wow.
Not at all.
It's a mental image I will never be able to scrub. also, host of Anime World Order Podcast and writer for OtakuUSA.com and Crunchyroll News, it's Daryl Surratt.
Hey, folks. I'm currently dressed up like every single member of Gem and the Holograms.
And returning to the show for the second time, we couldn't do this show without him. His name was the first one that came up. It's like, oh, we're going to do an 80s show. Who do we have on? Tim Eldred. Animator and editor of StarBlazers.com. Tim, thanks so much for coming back and agreeing to this.
Where the white women at?
All right, then.
That's a 70s reference.
Now would be a great time to say that obviously this podcast, the timing of it and the stuff we're going to be talking about, it's important to say this is dedicated to the memory of Noboru Ishiguro, who sadly left us, but was probably responsible for creating more anime fans in the 1980s than anyone else. I don't even think that's disputable. that guy's impact on anime and fandom was massive, and he's gone now, which is sad. But yeah, obviously, this is dedicated to him.
Yep, and I just want to thank Tim for being, when I interviewed Ishiguro, Tim was right there next to me, and it probably wouldn't have happened without Mr. Walter Amos, who's undoubtedly listening right now. So thank you very much for that. And if anyone wants to hear Tim and I interview Mr. Ishiguro, that's at our podcast.
Okay. All right. We should get started because we got a lot to get through here. I should just say for myself, this was a real process for me. The amount of 80s anime that I've seen is surprisingly low. I started in the late 90s and, you know, the 80s stuff was really kind of pushed on me by the old timers at my anime club. And therefore, it made me sort of react and it's kind of like, I'm not going to watch that old stuff. And I always meant to go back and see it, but I never did. So I took this opportunity to really go back. And in preparation for this, I watched 18 movies.
You did not sound like you were having a good time on Twitter. Not because I couldn't tell if you were disliking what you saw or if it was just the time crunch of having to watch that much stuff in a week.
It was a lot. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I finally got to see all of this stuff that I've been meaning to see forever. And it demystified the era for me. So all of the stuff that, you know, spoken about in hushed tones that I just never got around to, now I've seen it. It also makes my perspective on all of this stuff pretty fresh. So none of this, almost none of it, is coming from nostalgia for me. It's all fresh, right there.
Which is probably going to result in some very, very different choices.
I hope so, because to be honest, like it's hard to the 80s. Everybody talks about how there was a glut of stuff produced then. Going through the list, nowhere near as much as we have now. Like it's not that much stuff. It's, you know, there's plenty of it, but it's not as prolific as some people had led me to believe.
Well, also, a lot of it were easily dismissed kids shows that no one has even bothered releasing on DVD.
Yeah, totally. So this has been a learning experience, and I really enjoyed it. But we should get started with our number 10. And number 10, I think we should start here with Tim. Tim, what is your number 10?
All right, my number 10 is a movie. In fact, I've only got two movies on my entire list.
Wow.
Did you limit your intake to movies from the 80s? I'm sure you've seen some TV from that decade too, right?
Oh, I've seen plenty of TV and stuff from that decade. I've seen plenty of 80s stuff, but just in terms of what I had the time to consume, movies were sort of it. So, yeah, there's TV on my list, but yeah, anyway.
Okay, well, my entry for number 10, and I'm just going to call this my 10 favorites from the 80s,
right,
is Ado Galaxy Express 3-9.
All right.
The
good
second
choice.
Second of the Galaxy Express movies. Also happens to be the only Leiji Matsumoto production on my list for some reason.
Wow.
I did not choose the first movie for the simple reason that it came out in 79, and the second movie came out in 1980, or it might have been 81. I'm blanking on that at the moment. But the reason that I prefer Adieu over the first one is because everything that was learned on the first one was applied to the second. And it's got a very different look as well. Leiji Matsumoto is kind of a peculiar character, especially in his manga. Some of it doesn't look the same from panel to panel. And so it's really difficult to pin down the best elements of his style and not get sidetracked by the more unusual ones. And I think this was the first example of how to synthesize out the very best of Leiji Matsumoto in terms of story and image and put it all into one place. Other creators got pretty good at that in later decades, but Rintaro was the first, and I think he made what is the single best Leiji Matsumoto production of that decade.
Wow. Okay.
Now, I think it's important to note that most of the Leiji Matsumoto stuff that's held up as classic today was actually made in the 70s. So
yeah,
by this point, most of the great celebrated stuff had passed.
Wait, Justin, are you saying that DNA Sites 999.9, you know, is not going to be on your 90s list?
Alas, it is not.
Oh, man.
Well, for my money, next time we got something that was equal in stature to Ado 3-9 was in the aughts, when he started to team up with other artists who really figured out how to interpret his style and enhance it and make it really unique and interesting in the anime format.
Are you talking about the Galaxy Royalist, Tim?
Yes, and the Cockpit.
That was a good one.
The Cockpit was actually technically 80s, I think. It was 89. It was interesting. It's definitely one of my almost made it, but I think anthology format storytelling is really tough to make a connection, because we're really talking about three really short films that don't really have that much time to make an impression.
Yeah, that definitely influences what was on one of my almost made the list too.
Okay, well, with that in mind, Daryl, you want to go next?
Sure. My number 10 is guaranteed to start a fight somewhere, because a lot of times, much like the Oscars, I would pick things that were like the representative pick for a body of work. And so that I wouldn't just have a whole bunch of Studio Ghibli, Hayao Miyazaki type stuff, I tried to pick just one. And the one I picked is actually, it's Laputa Castle in the Sky as my number 10. Not Nausicaa, not Totoro, and here's why. Laputa in particular is a very grand scale adventure movie of the type that anime doesn't have, you know, quite as many of as I would like. And by classic adventure, I mean stuff like, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island kind of stuff. And, you know, it's very much, if you are willing to analyze it, certainly it's, you know, kind of politicized and, you know, the whole technology and, you know, the working class and such. But I think it's a really solid adventure movie, a good kids movie. It's very hard for me to go back and recommend Nausicaa as my pick, even though that's like one of the runaway top picks, just because I've gone and read the manga since. And the scale of the latter compared to the former is, it kind of colors my interpretation of the film, which, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, Laputa is just a really inventive movie. No wonder why Disney chose to release it as one of their first when they started releasing the movies in the U.S. I'd like to see, you know, the nice fancy Blu-ray, and I think I'll get my wish soon. But what do you guys think? Is that like a B-tier Ghibli for you guys?
For me,
no, I love it. It almost made my list, and I actually had a big mental battle with myself as to whether or not it should make it. The reason I don't think it's as memorable as Nazca is because the story meanders, and it, I mean, even calling it meandering is a little mean. It's more just long and really large in scope. But I think it's not as easily digestible for that reason.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I was referring to when I said, like, that old style of adventure novel or tale, like, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson type stuff is very much like that when you go and read those books, too.
Right. It almost feels like it would have been, had it been made 60 or 70 years earlier, it would have been like one of the first, you know, talkie serials for children or something.
I came very close to putting that on my top 10 as well. And I only knocked it out because I saw it after Nausicaa. And spoiler alert, Nausicaa is number 9 on my list. And the only reason that I consider it secondary is because of the order that I saw them, which was, you know, coincidentally the order they were made. And there were so many times when Laputa tried to achieve what Nausicaa had achieved, and it may have been a little unfair of us at the time, but I just remember so many of my friends saying, it's good, but it's no Nausicaa. And it may have been simply the order of viewing that decided that. If it had been flipped, it could have gone the other way.
I actually saw Nausicaa after Laputa after Nausicaa, and so maybe it's not a 100%, you know, one-to-one case of that. But I remember when I first saw the movie, I got Nausicaa and Laputa in the mail together, and so I watched one and then the other.
Oh.
Well, I think one thing that hurts Laputa is that it's the first Miyazaki film that really introduces antagonists that are a little wacky and lovable.
The gang.
Yeah, the pirates. I think that diminishes a lot of people's ability to take it as seriously as Nausicaa, which was stone serious throughout. It feels like one of the Don Bluth serious attempts at making a serious cartoon where there's just randomly a cartoon critter that does wacky things for 10 seconds and then back to the story. not that that is anywhere nearly as bad as what Don Bluth does, but I think the effect is somewhat the same.
Well, your reasoning totally stands. Basically, it's like you saw Nausicaa and then you read the comics, and the comics really do make you realize how much more that movie could have been. Like,
and specifically the characterization of some of the people. I mean, one character who's like a strong antagonist in the film is actually, you know, a alternate mirror image protagonist of the comic. And so in light of that, I was like, oh, that's kind of doing a disservice to the character in retrospect, seeing the film. And right. So that's kind of what I'm thinking, and from my side of things.
And since
perhaps if there was a Laputa manga, right, I would be thinking a different thing. But certainly I wasn't watching Laputa and thinking, this is nothing like Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah, well, it does stand alone. And so for that, like, I can agree with that that reasoning. All right, so Laputa, number 10. Justin.
My number 10 is one that I think will probably come up a lot later, so I'll bring it up now. It's Macross, Do You Remember Love?
Number 10, okay.
Now, my number 10. It's you know, when I was going through the giant list of films that came out in the 80s and OVAs and TV series, I was struck by two things. First, how much of it prior to 1984 was so obviously not intended as an adult work. Like, the vast majority of it, of anime, with you know, my very sci-fi based exceptions like the Leiji Matsumoto stuff and pretty much everything Yamato, it was almost predominantly, you know, giant robots of the Go Nagai ilk. And it was that and the fact that so much of it had very meandering storylines, and the original Macross TV series was very much guilty of this. It seemed like almost everything of the era just couldn't focus. And that made it really tough to wholeheartedly recommend any of it. I mean, I love a lot of it, but it's, as far as recommendations go, I think it really kind of ages a lot of the material from the decade early. And I think DYRL is probably one of the earliest examples of something that knew exactly the story it wanted to tell and told it in the most straightforward and not artificially weird way possible. And I think it's really kind of a turning point and kind of a milestone in anime storytelling for that reason alone.
And that was one that Mr. Ishiguro directed or co-directed, yes, as it were.
Possibly one of his greatest works.
I think it may also be one of the most beloved things from that era that's never seen a proper release here.
Actually, I'm pretty sure that's been that holds the record for number of times people have fan subbed it.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's super.
It's like that or Kimagure Orange Road.
Yeah. Yeah. Now people love the shit out of Do You Remember Love? Like, I cannot. The amount of people who sent that in is their, you know, most favorite thing. Just it's a little mind blowing. People really loved it.
It's really pretty even today, and you know, there are a lot of aspects of it that are either just laughable today or dated. Lin-Manmei songs, for example. Those
That's a 30-year anniversary, man.
Compare those to any other 30-year-old pop song. It doesn't even compete. Those were, and to be fair, they weren't really meant to be serious pop songs when they came out with the TV show. No one really expected that TV show to be what it was. And in the context of a really high budget, really, you know, blow the doors off, amazing film, it kind of looks a little wonky. But the rest of the film, including the big, you know, stuff blows up in space while music plays sequence, just one of the most indelible things in anime history, I think.
I kind of got to be a Debbie Downer on this one.
Uh-oh, not just me. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, fandom. I've fallen in and out of love with Macross a few times. And when I first saw Do You Remember Love, of course, I was completely blown away by the visuals. But as I went back to it in subsequent years, I found myself to be very disappointed with the character direction. There were so many scenes with pregnant pauses and side glances and gestures and just physical acting things that over the years just seemed to have less and less to do with how real people relate to each other and function in a group situation on an emotional level. And it's harder and harder for me to overlook that whenever I go back to the film. And it's been a few years. Every time I see it, I marvel at the mecha animation and the quality of the movement in the battle scenes. And that's all fantastic and has yet to be topped by anything else from that decade and maybe beyond. But I just cannot get past that the character direction. If it were live action, I think you'd have to wonder what that director was on to tell those actors to do what they're doing on screen.
Yeah, I saw Do You Remember Love for the first time last week, and I did not care for it. Oh. really at all. Yeah, the visuals are okay, but I got to be honest, like, I think maybe it holds more magic for you if you saw it 10, 15, 20 years ago, because it looks okay.
It's a distinct possibility.
It looks okay. It's not really all that great. It is a really corny movie. Really corny. From start
remember,
to finish.
Too, it was one of those culture-bearing movies that everybody tried to copy afterwards. So yeah. As a result, like John Carter, it looks less fresh as time goes on.
That's true. The sheer sort of stupidity of the plot, which is that this obnoxious pop singer gets kidnapped by aliens who then basically decide they don't want to fight humans anymore and want to revert to their human forms after hearing her song, is a dumb idea. It's a dumb idea, and it's really hard to pull off. And the movie's very serious about it. And it's just, the score is like the corniest goddamn thing. I mean, it's disco music playing behind these things. It's hard not to laugh. It's so cheesy. That whole sequence where, what's-his-face, the lead character, and Min-Mei are frolicking through the shopping arcade while there's this really cheesy disco thing going on in the background, and there's flashing lights, and oh, we're having ice cream. I mean, I was dying. Really, just I. But at the same time, like watching it, I can see, like, man, if I saw this in like 1986, my mind would have been blown. Like, this would have been totally amazing. Watching it now, ugh, yeah, no, thank you.
Yeah, I think this is one that might be exclusively the domain of the old timers. I really struggle to picture anyone under 20 getting into this film.
Like I said, it's a beloved film, and I can totally understand why. But something tells me we'll have the chance to discuss this film further as we go along. But on that note, I'm gonna I'll get to mine. Before I get to my number 10, I should mention there are a few things that didn't make the list that I just wanted to mention, just sort of contextualize this a little bit. Very nearly making it, but didn't make it, were Maze on Ikkoku, Robot Carnival, and Legend of the Galactic Heroes, which didn't get on the list because I haven't finished it yet. I feel like if I had finished that, it would totally be on my list, but I haven't had time to finish it. So, yeah. But otherwise, it would totally be there.
I was of two minds regarding Legend of the Galactic Heroes. I mean, it certainly started in the 1980s, so it counts as an 80s anime. But since so much of it was produced in the 90s, in my head, I always think of it as a 90s show. Yeah. But it's totally an 80s show.
Yeah, same here. I mean, it started, what, in 89?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah, so it was so late 80s and so weighted towards the 90s, I had a tough time justifying lumping it in with the 80s.
When were the novels published?
I don't know.
I would imagine in the 80s, right?
Yeah, most likely.
Shortly before.
Well, if it was informed by the 80s and started in the 80s, I think it qualifies.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, I have a few other, like, almost made the cut. You mentioned Robot Carnival. That's on mine. For the reasons that Justin said earlier, you know, with the anthologies, you know, you've only got so much time. And, you know, it's if each one is meant to be, like, wildly different from the previous, you know, there's invariably going to be at least one or two you're kind of cool on. And so that kind of, you know, bumped it off of my top 10. Nausicaa's on there as well. I just wanted one Miyazaki. Lupin the Third, the Fuma Conspiracy was another one that
close contender for me too.
I almost picked that. And just to be me, I have it on the list here. I'm not sure if it was just me trying to think of titles, but I certainly like it. Guaranteed to be on nobody's top 10 list or also ran Goku Midnight Eye.
What? Really?
Hell yes. No, I'm just looking at what I had written down here, and I haven't opened in, you know, roughly a week. I should have a disclaimer. You know, my top 10 will change every 5 minutes, but I've committed myself to this top 10 for this recording.
Yeah. My also rans also include Maze on Ikkoku, which is lovable, but I can't ever see myself rewatching it.
Yeah, me neither.
I'm the same way. I got the manga for that. And yeah,
it's so slow and frustrating and meandering, although the characters you just want to sit with. I didn't feel that Robot Carnival, as much as I love Robot Carnival, it's nowhere near best of the decade, mostly because most of the segments are kind of terrible today. probably less than three of them are still amazing. And then you have ones like Starlight Angel, which is a girl gets to fly around a super 80s disco-y amusement park with a hot guy. No.
That was my favorite one, Justin.
I know. But one of my biggest also rans was definitely Neo Tokyo.
Yep.
Which, honestly, the one that gets all the attention is the Running Man, right? Kawajiri's short, which got on MTV here. Honestly, I think that's the least of the three shorts. The Rintaro one, Labyrinth, is amazing. It's possibly one of the greatest, you know, non-narrative anime big screen things ever. And also the Katsuhiro Otomo segment, Order to Stop Construction, is possibly one of his best works. It's just this searing indictment of the Japanese salaryman. It's to this day, it's one of the things I mentally reference when goofing on Japanese culture.
Yeah, I meant to revisit that one, but I ran out of time. But I do remember. I remember the last segment, the clearest.
Yeah,
I know that one. It also had, I think, I feel like it had some of the best imagery in the set.
Oh yeah, visually it was great, and it was laugh out loud hilarious in a very adult way, which is something we still don't get much of in anime.
Okay, all right, my number 10 is Mobile Suit Gundam, the movie trilogy,
not tetralogy.
You mentioned that because I put that out there on Twitter, and then you came back with tetralogy. What do you? I mean, I'll talk about Gundam in a minute, but what do you consider included in that?
I consider the original 007-9 films and then Shaw's Counterattack, because that is the full story of the Amuro Ray Shaw Osnabal dynamic from beginning to end.
Oh, I thought quadrilogy was the word for four movies.
Quadrilogy is a term made up by a Fox marketing executive when selling the Alien box set.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's become accepted enough that, yeah, people will take a quadrilogy to mean four films.
Well, okay, I have Charles Counterattack. It is sitting on my coffee table. I did not get to it because after 7.5 hours of Gundam, I was done and I didn't want to watch anymore.
Let me give you a warning. Shaw's Counterattack is the most concentrated essence of Gundam in the history of anything ever, for all that entails.
Well, I will totally watch it, but first I needed to see the original. Now, I have never seen any Gundam start to finish, ever. This is actually my first all the way through any Gundam anything. And I will tell you that while this is on here mostly because it's really important. The show is incredibly important to almost everything that came after it. And I'm really glad that I saw it. Now, the show is primarily for war nerds. That is really who it's for. People who get obsessed with tactics and, you know, that sort of a thing. It's sort of for military nuts. That is sort of what I took away from it. Like, oh, I understand, because this is really big among people who are totally into, like, you know, mapping out all the battles of World War II or whatever. That's what it seems like primarily who it's for. But it is a good story. It's compelling. It stops and starts a little bit. But overall, those movies are a really good, relatively condensed version of a huge story that I enjoyed seeing through to the end. I think I got about halfway through the second movie. And then that instinct, like, I started this, I'm going to finish it, I might be a little bored right now, and there's another 5 hours worth of this to watch, but I'm totally going to get through it. And I'm really glad I did. I think if you're interested in the history of anime, it's something you should go through as a rite of passage, almost. Like, yes, I have sat through 7.5 hours of Gundam, I did it. I know that show. I will get these references and jokes now. It will all make sense to me. And historically, you'll understand so much of what came after it and why so much like it came after it.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Why can you not apply that same line of reasoning to Do You Remember Love?
Because Do You Remember Love was just so hokey. I get it. Like I said, I can appreciate Do You Remember Love for what it is. I totally get why people love it. I just personally thought it was hokey.
I think if you watch the Gundam TV show, you'll see how hokey that show was. They really, like, when you said this is for military tactics and serious business kind of stuff, that is largely the result of Yoshikazu Yasuhiko kind of taking the reins of those theatrical films and recutting it and, you know, trimming a lot of fat from the original product to make it that way. The original one is very close to those old 70s Monster of the Week style shows. Very, you know, more kid-like.
And well, it was very transitional. Edits. Everything that came before it, as you know, fits into what they used to call the super robot category, and Gundam redefined that into real robot. That was sort of a retroactive term applied later. But yeah, especially if you look at the design of the bad guy robots and the color schemes, they are firmly rooted in the 70s aesthetic.
And, you know, my problem with Gundam has actually kind of was best summed up by Tim when we were discussing Do You Remember Love? Those characters do not act like people.
No.
And as a result, I just couldn't care about them.
Well, the other thing is that at least in the films, the overt sexism in Gundam is far less offensive than it is in Do You Remember Love? Do You Remember Love is intensely sexist. Like, insultingly so. It's very sexist, and Gundam is a little sexist, but not as much. And so I guess on that level, I found it to be less off-putting. But you know, Gundam gets really silly. Like the third movie, we've got Char driving a covered wagon, and it basically it ends with these really weird-looking, like, psychic battles in space where there's colored lights and they're, like, flying around each other and dreaming of the ocean. And I mean, it gets silly, but I feel like the train never quite goes far enough off the tracks in order for it to just devolve into nothingness. As a narrative, it concludes very well. It tells you it generally sticks to important events and important characters, at least in these movie versions. And I felt like as an experience taken as a whole, if you want to be familiar with, like, the history of anime, this is something you should probably see. Whether or not it's the most compelling thing in the world is another discussion. But Gundam.
Well, Well, it's definitely the best version of that particular story. If you had to choose between that and the TV series, there's a lot of elements in the series that are disjointed.
Yeah.
And I think, quite famously, Tomino hadn't really come up with the new type concept until maybe the midpoint, at which time he started to work it into the scripts. And, of course, since the movies were made retroactively, they could build up to that element instead of just shoehorning it in. And so it did a much better job of unifying the concepts.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a more refined version because, you know, the original was canceled. It only made it to like 40 episodes and they had to sort of rush it. And I know for these movies, they redid the ending and reanimated it all and made it look better. And it's just a more refined vision of what he was trying to make. At the same time, watching this, and everybody always refers to it this way, at least in like mainstream media, if this is supposed to be the Star Trek of Japan, the two shows have virtually nothing in common.
They're very popular sci-fi shows.
That's the only thing, yeah.
I always come down firmly on the side of Star Trek and Yamato being much more closely related.
Oh, yeah.
And Gundam and Star Wars being much more closely related for no other reason than the size of the merchandising machine attached to it.
Yeah. The presence of the beam sabers.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm usually of the thought that, you know, Gundam is more sci-fi and, you know, things like Macross is more space opera like Star Wars. But maybe that might explain why nobody seems to act like normal human beings, because it's a melodramatic, you know, opera kind of thing. But who knows, maybe people just don't know how to write.
One last observation on this, I bought the movie trilogy DVDs from Bandai, and it never ceases to make me laugh, and I always feel so bad for the translators whenever they're forced to use whatever ridiculous fucking name Sunrise is forcing them to use, because you can hear them saying something else. And the subtitles have this ridiculous name. And like the female sort of not really love interest, it's supposed to be Frau, like the German word for miss, Frau Bo. And the subtitles, it's Frau, F-R-A-W, Frau Bo. For 7.5 hours, everyone's, Frau, how's it going? It's like, oh, Jesus. It's so weird.
Well, I'm still stinging after all these years that somebody decided to put an R on Shaw. That has led to so many mispronunciations. It makes me want to punch people.
Yeah, I still say char.
Yeah. It's hard not to. Okay, so that wraps up number 10. Let's get to some user lists. We asked our listeners and on the forums to send in their top threes from the 80s, and I will start. I will start with the forums here. Derek the Red, his top three: number one, Touch; number two, Macross. I think he means the TV series. Number three, Pat Labour the movie, which I think we'll be talking about later. Eichel Chicken sent in number one, Akira; number two, Crusher Joe the movie; number three, Black Magic M66, which I think that's the only list I saw that on.
I really like that. I almost put it on, but I'm like, nah.
And from G Ultra 2764, Macross again, Kimigori Orange Road, Kiki's Delivery Service. So yeah, we'll keep reading these as we go along, but it's always good to get a second, third, fourth, and fifth opinion. All right, so I think we're ready for number nines. This time, let's start with Daryl.
All right, my number nine is Fist of the North Star. Just using
what?
That as a catch-all. That's right.
Excuse me, number nine.
Yeah, my number nine. I've got like I said, other things might, you know, rearrange that list as needed, but Fist of the North Star is on here because it is basically the forerunner of the modern shonen action adventure, you know, that dominates all the top most popular lists to this day. Their Shonen Jump formula was basically established here, along with Dragon Ball later. I mean, maybe this is the Bruce Lee to Dragon Ball's Jackie Chan. It's pretty silly. You know, you want to talk about a goofy show, Fist of the North Star is it. You know, certainly it's quite inexpensive or, you know, inconsistently budgeted. But this is where, you know, all the great character archetypes come from. This is where a lot of the unfortunate, you know, production side of how to make these shows comes from. I mean, some episodes are notoriously low budget, but it drove a lot of innovation as far as how to animate stuff, and also gave the important message of how to kill, maim, and murder in a show for 9-year-old children. And I think that's really what makes anime truly great. That's the sort of thing that catches people's eye about, you know, this kind of stuff. Fist of the North Star, you know, the legacy of it has, you know, endured to this day. They're still making more of it. There's still new manga. There's still new cartoons. It may be driven by Pachi Slot at this point, but like everything else is. But yeah, I mean, maybe if you caught me on another day, that might be my, you know, top three or my number one. But, you know, right now it's my number 9.
Wow, I'm stunned after identifying yourself so closely with that show for so long. It didn't place higher. Well, don't worry, it placed higher for me.
Interesting. All right, Justin?
Mine is actually Pat Labor OVA.
Okay.
The original, not V-Series. V-Series is 90s and kind of sucks. The original 7-part OVA was, very Mamoru Oshii, very technically kind of amazing for an OVA of its day, and really a precursor to a lot of what came later in the really amazing Pat Labor movies. I think most people would agree that the second Pat Labor movie is easily the best Pat Labor anything, but that was made in the 90s, so I'm not counting it. There's it did a really good job of introducing this ragtag bunch of almost American sitcom like, you know, kind of Bad News Bears police force, but at the same time it didn't succumb to outright childish silliness like the TV series did. Not that the TV series didn't have great moments, but it's just kind of meh. The OVA series is just, it's kind of, it's cerebral without being too smart, and it's still somewhat accessible. I just love it. I can pop it in on a rainy day and just kind of, you know, it's a nice warm blanket mecha show, if that makes any sense.
I think the strength of Pat Labor, Justin, is its versatility, that it can be cerebral and it can be silly and it can be political drama, and it all seems cohesive. It doesn't seem like they've suddenly hit the brakes and made a totally different show, because the characterizations are consistent regardless of whether or not it's a monster drama akin to like a Godzilla sort of movie, or whether there's an attempted takeover of the government. I think that's really where Pat Labor shines, and perhaps, you know, I'm not one of the people who believe this, but I know some people are a little down on Pat Labor too, just because the focus is only on a few characters as opposed to the ensemble.
Yeah, but they're the greatest characters.
Oh, well, they're certainly my favorites. I mean, I'm a Goto person myself. But, you know, if you come for the whole package, you know, then maybe the second movie is not really getting that so much. But, yeah, the first set of OAVs is pretty darn strong. There's not really a weak episode in the set. There's only 7 of them. Certainly the later ones were much longer, and, you know, there's some ups and some downs. But I wouldn't write off the second OAV, you know, quite so quickly. But hey, that's a 90s show, so
true.
Off limits for now.
All right, Pat Labor OVAs. Okay, Tim?
My number 9, which I already tipped in the number 10 segment, is Nausicaa.
All right.
1984 from Studio Ghibli. And the reason that...
Studio Topcraft, Tim.
Sorry. I guess you're right. Yeah, we didn't see Ghibli as a name until Lampedusa, correct?
Yeah, that's okay. True.
All right. Well, then I stand corrected. But in spirit, I think it's the first true Ghibli film.
Yeah.
And
yeah, absolutely. Or maybe Cagliostro.
Sure. The reason that I choose that over all the others is that I saw it in my early 20s at a time when my head was filled with fantasy and space opera, and I wasn't too interested in earthbound stories. And for that reason, to see Miyazaki working at his peak in a fantasy environment that he created himself meant that that film was suffused with a purity that I don't think I'd seen from him since. In his later films, it became much more obvious that he was in love with Europe and European architecture, and worked much harder to make it the setting for his stories. But speaking to me as a early 20s anime viewer, he knocked me on the floor with Nausicaa. Everything about it was so beautiful and so new and so clean and fresh. I think that's just going to keep it on the top of the pyramid for me for a long time to come. Now, as the decade went on, I think I landed on Porco Rosso as my favorite Miyazaki film viewed as an adult mm-hmm. because of the different sensibilities it created. And since I've made a few trips to Europe, I've come to appreciate his aesthetic a little bit more. And it's always nice to see that, you know, now that I've had the real world experience to connect to it. But still, Nausicaä being a fantasy film and very strongly pioneered by the guy who created it just gives it the edge. And I did read the manga afterward, which, of course, is a much bigger story with many more layers. And I think if I had gone in the reverse order, I might have liked the movie a little bit less. But as a lead into the manga, it works just perfectly. So there it is.
I wouldn't have picked up that manga had I not seen the movie and loved it as much as I did.
Yeah,
I'm of the exact same mind. This was actually the first anime I ever saw as Warriors of the Wind, but with no preconceived notions, even as a kid, it blew me away, and it blew my parents away. Like they knew it was something special, and it takes a special film to do that to Americans in the 80s.
Yeah, that Warriors of the Wind dub gets a lot of flack, I think just because it's always stylish to jump on early English dubs. But I saw that early on. In fact, I think that was the first actual video copy I got of the film, and I didn't dislike it at all. It got the job done.
I think the main reason why people bag on early dubs like Warriors of the Wind and a lot of the streamlined stuff is more the script and the edits than the actual acting. Because it's my opinion that a lot of the acting is actually fairly well done. The problems with it that make it, you know, a quote bad dub is the rewrites and the cuts and the edits and that sort of thing. I think a lot of people don't really compartmentalize those aspects as just one cohesive, you know, the English dub isn't good.
Sure.
All right. So I think this may be this is our first agreement, probably not expected, but my number 9 is also Fist of the North Star. I had not seen this until last week, and it had always been one of those things like, I should get around to Fist of the North Star someday. Daryl won't shut up about it.
I haven't really said much about it in a long time compared to other people on Twitter who are now doing that heavy lifting for me.
Right. Just joking, Daryl. But
I'm also just joking.
It is something that I have always meant to see, and I'm glad I saw it. It is corny as hell, but it is also kind of a perfect distillation of that 1980s post-apocalyptic hellscape thing that was en vogue back then. I think it's probably better than most of the post-apocalyptic stuff that came out in the 80s. And it kind of goes to the place you always want those movies to go to, which is, look, if you're going to be super violent and you're going to be about these ridiculous gangs, just go for it. And it does. It's totally over the top. It is absolutely ridiculous. And I really had a fun time with it. I don't think it's a fantastic movie. I don't think it's particularly brilliant or genius in any way. It's big, dumb, fun. That also kind of says a lot about what anime used to be to people. It used to be this, like, totally fucking R-rated hardcore shit. And Fist of North Star is nothing but R-rated. That along with, like, you know, something like a Ninja Scroll totally told a lot of people what anime was and why it was different and why it was this thing in the Blockbuster Video that you gotta rent without your parents finding out and stuff. it represents a lot to me about what anime used to be. And it's a cool movie. It's something to see.
The ending of that movie is so out of character sad, especially because, you know, a lot of people saw it in the dub, and the dub didn't have the vocal track on that song. But if you see it subtitled and you have that song, holy crap, that is the most devastatingly sad piece of animation I've seen ever. But it's... for what you're expecting that ending to be, it just socks you in the face.
Well, there's a couple of different endings.
He's referring to the movie. Not the parts in the changed. There are two different animated endings in the movie, Justin. But what you're referring to is the song during the closing credits, and that footage isn't altered in either edition.
Well, there are very few moments in any segment of Fist of the North Star where they can pull back from the hectic story and just sort of reflect on everything that's been lost in the nuclear holocaust that starts off the story itself. And that end title sequence, which has a song on it called Purple Eyes, is one of those moments. It's one of those times when the story stops and you just look at the world for what it's become. And it's really effective.
Yeah, I really wasn't expecting to enjoy that movie as much as I did. I really wasn't. I thought, all right, corny 1980s Japanese masculinity, okay. But no, it was cool. I enjoyed it. I'm surprised.
A lot of people just can't get past the, you know, the people that if you prick them with a needle, they could water your lawn with their blood.
Yeah, that is pretty ridiculous. There's a lot of raining blood, and they really enjoyed animating big beefy guys getting segmented into various pieces. They liked doing that. Okay, so our user top threes for number 9. Exidor US, number 1, Project Aiko, number 2, Do You Remember Love, number 3, Bobby's Girl. Actually, not the only list with Bobby's Girl on it. I was surprised.
Really?
Yeah. There was a time long ago when, you know, my friend, my co-host, Gerald from Anime World Order, when he purchased Bobby's Girl on VHS, got a note from the store that said, "How do you even know what this is? Japanese people don't even know what this is."
You know, it's
maybe
got
the
some,
works of that and Buried Treasure have gotten the word of Bobby's Girl out.
Maybe. I mean, it's got some great, great animation, but as a story, I wasn't sure I could recommend it in a top 10 list. I mean, interesting to watch, certainly, but top 10 material, I couldn't do it.
It's an animator's playhouse.
It really is.
All right, J.R. Nimenich, number 1, Legend of the Galactic Heroes, number 2, My Neighbor Totoro, number 3, Mobile Suit Gundam 0080, War in the Pocket.
Was War in the Pocket 80s?
Oh, yeah, 89. It's
89.
And finally, Penguin Truth, Legend of the Galactic Heroes, Wings of Onimus, and Zeta Gundam. I have heard nothing but, hey, you really don't need to watch Zeta Gundam from...
Zeta Gundam used to be the crown jewel of, like, mecha animation, and in recent years, the opinion towards Zeta Gundam has done a hard 180. Perhaps maybe it's an issue of more people are able to actually see it than hear people talk about it. I don't know.
We're on to our number 8s, and this time, why don't we start with you, Justin?
Okay. My number 8 is one that I think will appear in a lot of top 10 lists. It's Wings of Onimus.
Not a surprise.
No.
Call me shocked.
God, this film is pretty. Yeah. God, this film has some great moments. God, this film has one horrifying moment that almost derails the entire film.
Yes, it does.
That said, I acknowledging it for what it is and, you know, throwing every possible interpretation of it to excuse it, maybe I can somewhat overlook that and just see the rest of the film, which you can't. I think it's a huge mistake to damn the whole film for that one moment. As far as visionary world building, I think Wings of Onimus is possibly unmatched in anime history.
And that is something that I've noticed about almost all our picks that we've all given so far, is they've all really created, like, well-realized worlds. But certainly Onimus takes it to another level.
Right. And, I mean, even constructing alternate world religions for people, I think, is really interesting and insightful in, I mean, very, very few anime get into religiosity in any serious way. I mean, the cult-produced movies notwithstanding. And there are just some... You could frame and hang on your wall every frame of this film. It is that gorgeous, that meticulously animated, lost that much money initially. It's something that could definitely never be made in any other state of economy other than Japanese insane bubble economy. And we're better for it, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't make my top 10. For one very simple reason. The criteria I applied to all my choices was repeatability.
Oh, yeah.
And while you can certainly get something new out of Onimus every time you see it, I just have not felt compelled to watch it that often. One or two viewings have seemed to hold me pretty well for a while.
Well,
I think karmically Carl Horn is rewatching it enough times to make up for that one.
It's kind of a slog. I mean, it's a good movie, but it's long and it's slow. And that world building is a lot of what that movie does. It does it very well, but that is pretty much what it's doing for a long portion of its runtime.
See, I find it kind of relaxing. It's a movie I can, you know, if it, the mediocre but passable English dub. I can have it on in the background and just kind of, you know, oh, this is a fun thing to visit until that one scene.
Rape.
Yeah.
That wasn't 10 in a second.
I didn't claim I could.
Yeah, that I have to admit, I revisited this because I hadn't seen it in years and years and years, and it's not on my runners up, primarily because of that scene. And I think the problem with it is, it's clear what they're trying to do. They are building this character up as truly representative of humanity. He's questioning his own worth, whether or not he's a good person, whether or not he deserves to go to the stars, whether or not he's even, you know, worthy of that climb. And they chose to show his dark side in an incredibly tasteless way that is just a terrible, terrible choice for that movie. It is such a bad idea, and it's handled very poorly. And for me, it derails it. It throws it off the tracks. And while I can appreciate and admire that film, that choice ruined it for me. Yeah, so that's kind of where I am on Onions.
You know, so much of 80s anime, so much of it is just outwardly misogynistic, even by today's anime standards. It's kind of there's enough of an argument to be made there that Japan of the 80s was so misogynistic that you almost have to just accept it.
If
you're looking seriously at the content made in that era.
Yeah, okay. I can agree with that. However, it's enough to keep it off my list.
Fair enough.
definitely enough. All right, Daryl?
My number 8 had a bit of difficulty on this one, but maybe it's considered a bit of a representative overall pick. My Youth in Arcadia. Believe that was 1982.
Yep.
Yeah. Certainly... one of Leiji Matsumoto's, you know, most famous characters, Captain Harlock. Certainly the old television series Space Pirate Captain Harlock from 78 is now freely available to see streaming online. But as acclaimed as that show is, I feel that the 42 episodes or whatever its runtime was a bit much to sort of get the story. And even though there's not really the same story being told in this at all, it's almost a prequel in a sense. This one film encapsulates what makes Captain Harlock such an icon as a character. It's all about, you know, it's, you know, if you want to know how did he get, you know, his missing eye and such, this is the film that sort of quasi explains that. There's no real continuity between Matsumoto's work, but I think this, perhaps even more so than Yamato or Star Blazers, is a good introduction to the works of Leiji Matsumoto. You know, perhaps we can have some discussion on that as time goes on. But this movie was, you know, tremendously influential to, you know, a lot of other things that came after it. It got released, you know, more times in America than I care to count. The current imprint still, as far as I can tell, is Anime Eagle's release, which uses the name Arcadia of My Youth.
Not in print.
It's not in print anymore. Oh, boy.
Way not in print. It's really expensive on Amazon.
Ah, that's a pretty... Maybe Discotech can get that one again. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, this one, like, I didn't know who Captain Harlock was. I just see, like, the picture and, you know, the iconic thing. Maybe for people who want to know, like, hey, where'd the guy from Last Exile come from? Oh, he's like this guy. Check out this movie. There's plenty of other Captain Harlock animations out there, but they're much, much longer, and some of them just aren't as good. And so I think that this film is really the one that's got like the bombast and the pathos that make Leiji Matsumoto, you know, the name that he is.
Yeah, I think to make the parallel with Miyazaki, as Nausicaa was Miyazaki's purest work, I think My Youth in Arcadia has the same position in the Matsumoto lineup. And I came very close to choosing that over Adieu 3-9 as my number 10. But I think Adieu 3-9 had the little extra edge to it that Rintaro brought to the table to edge it up, you know, just a little higher. But I agree, if you want to see what Matsumoto is capable of accomplishing when he's got his hands on the steering wheel and he's completely focused on the job, Myotin Arcadia is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, I watched this as part of my curriculum for this, and I have my experience with Matsumoto stuff is sort of woefully small, but I'd always meant to see this, and I gotta say, the thing that struck me the most about it is that it is Japanese old guy the movie. Like, it is absolutely like by an old Japanese guy for old Japanese guys. And if it had a smell, I think it would smell like engine grease and old people. That is that movie. I liked it okay. I admittedly I found the story to be a little but I definitely could see where people would really love it. And it does have that bombast like you were talking. It's a very manly film, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay, Tim, then that brings us to your number eight.
My number eight. This will bring in, I think, the first TV series that we've discussed, and I'll be curious to know if any of you have seen it. It's called Panzer World Galliant, and it's from 1984.
Oh, boy. No. Yep, I've seen some of it, but not all. I'm interested that you picked Galliant and not Dugram or, you know, of course, maybe something else that'll be later on your list.
Yeah. Well, Dugram, I think, is almost inaccessible because it's kind of hard to find, and it's also extremely long and extremely slow. So that didn't make my top 10, but I love Galliant for the opposite reason, in that it is very tight. It runs 25 episodes, which may sound like a lot to today's viewers, but every episode is packed. And that is a testament to its creator, Ryusuke Takahashi, who I think is the single most disciplined anime writer you could ask for. Very little filler, very little waste. Everything that happens contributes to the story without sidetracking it. And just in terms of an overall blanket description, I would say Lord of the Rings mixed with a little Dune with giant robots. If that's your thing, this is a great show for you.
Can we get a? I've heard of this in passing. My knowledge of it is very limited. Can we get like a brief story synopsis?
It's an alien invasion story, but you don't find that out for a while. And I can say that without spoiling it because it's revealed pretty early on, and there are a lot of the hints that you get in the first five episodes. What makes it different and interesting is it's not an invasion on Earth. As we know it, it takes place on another planet entirely, and it's a sort of feudal medieval society, and the invading force gives it technology. It's basically a story about what happens if you really violate the Prime Directive, and it changes the entire society of this planet, and it requires some outside help to keep the planet itself in balance. And I think if I were to describe anything beyond that, I would get into spoiler territory, so I'm going to leave it there.
Has this been fan-subbed in its entirety?
Yes, it has.
As is Dugram, as is, you know, a lot of that stuff.
Okay, so you can get it if you want it, and unfortunately, fan-sub is probably the only way you will ever be able to see that. But yeah, cool, all right. It's good to see something that's not super
overexposed.
Obvious. Yeah, totally overexposed.
And I have to say also that the opening and closing titles are fantastic. If you were to just isolate those songs and listen to them independent of the anime, they're still just as emotionally gripping as they are in context.
Okay, then that's my number eight. My number eight is, didn't expect this to be on here, but it is Angel's Egg, the Mamoru Oshii, fairly incomprehensible art film from the late 80s.
It's one of my favorites, too. It's not on my list, oddly enough.
But. Yeah, it's sort of legendary for being, you know, arty and pretentious and all that stuff.
Impenetrable is the word that I would...
Impenetrable, yes. And it is. It is all of those things. In fact, as an art film... I'm not sure what it's trying to say. I really don't know. Why this is on here and why I liked it so much is because the sheer promise of what can be done in animation is kind of represented here. This is straight up an art film. It could easily just be a book of stills, even though, you know, it's decently animated, but there's not that much animation that needs to be done in it. And the fact that it is representative of what is pure art cinema, except it's animated, that's cool. And it shows you just how risk-taking they really were back in the 80s. Like, they were actually willing to put money into this and release it theatrically. Now, I understand it was a critical and commercial flop, And only in the last like 7 or 8 years has it been sort of dug up and people sort of refer to it as one of Oshii's seminal works, I guess. But for people who don't know what this is, basically you spend a long time in a ruined city following this little girl around who has an egg, and she's very protective of it, and there's this weird hunter guy who's got like this bow, and then there's these whalers who hunt they're like coelacanths, but they're these giant fish shadows. Don't really know what that's supposed to mean.
I've reviewed this on my own podcast a while ago, and I sort of summarized Angel's Egg as being, you know, for one thing, it's a very visual film. There's very little dialogue in it, and so perhaps it was a popular thing to watch back in the ye olden days when subtitling tape was a little difficult. If you're a fan of Yoshitaka Amano, you know, the famous artist who did a lot of the Final Fantasy and Vampire Hunter D art, this is kind of like one of his, you know, top exhibits of what his, you know, art style resembles, yeah. In animated form anyway. As far as thematically, I kind of think it's about the loss of faith, specifically religious faith. I think it's sort of well known that Mamoru Oshii was a pretty religious guy. I think he was possibly considering entering seminary at one point. But I mean, this is a film in which a soldier whose weapon is a cross stands knee deep in water in a sea of dead fish and animals and says the flood never happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely a very a spiritual sort of based film. Certainly there's, of course, the obligatory Oshii scripture quotation. But he's not just throwing out a random passage of the Bible. It is related to what I think is going on, but it's completely open to argument. So,
yeah, no, that's a good point. And those themes are very obviously there. It's clear the film is saying something about faith. What exactly it's saying is pretty open to interpretation and open for discussion. That's the nature of art cinema. You can interpret it any number of ways you want. And I think as a piece of art cinema, it's pretty effective. I think it's good, and I don't know. I enjoyed it. It's also short. It's only about 1 hour and 10 minutes, which you don't really want it to be any longer than that.
Like, wait, you think you shouldn't just take Angel's Egg and intersperse live-action footage into the film and call it In the Aftermath? Has anyone seen In the Aftermath?
No, I've heard. Is it available?
Oh, someone gave me a copy of it, but I don't know if it's commercially available. But
yeah, man. I don't think because I heard that Anchor Bay picked it up ages ago, but I think that was one that they just never released, and they were worried that they just didn't have the rights to all of the assets to it, which is probably fair.
But yeah, In the Aftermath, well, someone decided, hey, we got this cool imagery from this weird cartoon. Let's take some weird post-apocalyptic people wandering around in a desert with, you know, gas masks and stuff, and you know, intercut it with this cartoon footage. And they did all right.
Indeed. You know, this film is so... I like dark and impenetrable things, but this film was a little too much for me. I mean, to be fair, I don't think I was in the right frame of mind when I saw it. I think I need to see it when well-rested and just kind of idle so I could be prepared to just sit in its themes. But I don't know. It's a tough one.
Not the kind of thing that would go over well at your local anime club.
No.
Yeah, and it always emptied the room every time they tried to put it on. So there you go. It was infamous back then for being like, oh, this is this thing. No one knows what it is. And it stands to reason. This is something that belongs. It should be screened at the Guggenheim for people who are very interested in that particular type of art cinema. It does not belong on a roster with episodes 3 and 4 of Saber Marionette J and then Angel's Egg. Like, no, it doesn't belong in there. It's not even really classified the same way.
Nothing belongs on a roster with Saber Marionette J.
Moving on. Okay, user top threes for number 8. Erica Friedman sent in Mobile Suit Gundam 0080 War in the Pocket, Yurisi Atsura, and this is a cheat, and I've struggled with whether or not this counted, but she has Rose of Versailles on here. And Rose of Versailles...
I count that as 70s.
That's definitely 70s.
It started in 79. The bulk of the show ran in 1980. So it's hard for
me. This was my same argument for Legend of the Galactic Heroes being 90s, and everyone was like, no, it's absolutely 80s. We got to be consistent.
I consider it a cheat. No Cagliostro, no Rosa Versailles, but hey, she put it on there, so she put it on there. All right, Land of Obscusion put God Bless Dan Cougar, Metal Armor Dragonar, and Arion.
It's pretty interesting that he'd say Dragonar over Gundam. And, you know, I certainly know what all these shows are. But, yeah, I mean, Arion is definitely a pretty solid Yoshikazu Yasuhiko work, but more so than the Gundam trilogy. I'm not sure. I kind of think he's trying to live up to his name and be the Land of Obscusion. You know, weird stuff.
I first saw Arion recently, and although I thought it was really pretty and interesting visually, that story is a mess.
Yeah. Okay. And Redacted Text, number 3, Onyamas, number 2, Venus Wars, and number 1, Palabur. So there you go.
Venus Wars is another interesting Yasuhiko pick. Man, that guy was on fire in the 80s.
I like Venus Wars. I liken it to like an American war blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the lead is actually one of the Johnny's guys. He was like from Shonen Tai or something. So it was literally an action blockbuster.
Wow.
That's a crowd pleaser.
Indeed. Okay, I think we're ready to move on to number 7. This time, let's start with Tim.
Okay, number 7 for me is an OAV series titled Armor Hunter Merrowlink.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, nice.
And ran 12 episodes, came out in 88, and it's a spinoff of Armored Trooper Votums, which I'll get into much later. It's a fugitive story set in that same universe in which there's an event that leads into the Votums TV series but has an impact on a different set of characters. And the title character, whose name is Merrowlink, has to go on the lam as a fugitive from his own army. And he's got his own death note that he carries around in his head. And he spends the entire series hunting down those who were responsible for getting him into this fix. What makes it different from the TV series is that he is not a robot pilot. He actually starts out that way, but he becomes what they call an armor hunter, which is someone who specializes in taking down mecha. But
while on foot.
He's on foot, right. So it adds a really interesting dimension to mecha anime that I don't think anybody ever tried before or since. One man versus one mecha. Two enter, one leave. And there's a lot of twists and turns and a lot of cliffhanger moments and some terrific action sequences and some great music. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, I saw the first four. There was like a tape of Armor Hunter Merrowlink that had the first four episodes on it that circulated real heavily back in the fan sub VHS days. And I remember really liking that and never getting around to seeing the rest of it. I always meant to.
Yeah, it's been fan subbed at least twice that I'm aware of, maybe more. And I think it's one of those that's short enough and accessible enough that it's getting a little more attention as the years go on. And it also was a terrific example of how you could take a huge mecha series and twist it in different directions. And I'm really sorry they didn't continue to do that because the world of Votums is gigantic and there's no limit to the number of stories that could be told there. However, there is a limit to how much merchandising people will accept, and that seems to be kind of the driving force behind that franchise.
Yeah, you can't really sell a giant gun with a stake on the end of it to the kids as well as you can a plastic toy robot. But well, maybe you can sell them like the blood or the mud or the oil or whatever to smear on your face before you go into the kill.
Yeah, not very hygienic, I'll have to say that. But there's a lot of really interesting mecha variation in the show. Which got almost no merchandising, which surprises me a little bit. There's got to be an interesting business story behind why certain decisions were made and not made connected to this. Because if it were a Gundam series, it would be on many top 10 lists. It just didn't have the merchandising muscle behind it to keep it alive after it was over with.
Yeah, well, I know when I saw it, I thought it was a really, really cool idea, and they were executing it really well. Like it's a neat concept that really you don't see that often. Like one dude just taking down robots.
Yep.
You know, you don't really see it. Okay, Justin?
My number 7?
Yeah.
That would be Gundam 0080 War in the Pocket.
All right.
Nice.
I love this show because of my probably in no small part because of my very well-known love of child trauma anime.
Mm-hmm. So you edit out the closing credits, you know, each time.
Oh, no, the closing credits are the best part.
I know.
Oh, my God. But that aside, I think this is the problem that I have with a lot of big, huge war story anime is that it's really hard to connect emotionally for me because it's just the issues are too big. The worldview is too complicated. I feel like I need a personal take on what that war means in order for it to mean anything to me. And War in the Pocket does that in spades. I mean, it is from a kid's point of view, and initially it's war is really, really exciting, and then you get a little too close, then you see what it actually does, and then that incredible crushing sense of loss to someone who's still, you know, a little soft and green, that is just, it's world-ending, and the way this show kind of has this, you know, tongue sticking out as it just really drives home just how destructive war is, I think, is just kind of unprecedented and it just really makes a mark.
Yeah, I think between those two picks, The Wings of Oniyami's and 0080, I think Hiroyuki Yamaga used up like all his creative energy in making those because everything he made since never really quite measured up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that one's next on my list of Gundam things that I will check out.
That's another one that just didn't really get the merchandising push around it because it's such a personal story. There aren't really a whole lot of shiny robots to sell to people in terms of you know, model kits and the like. And so it's always sort of like the one that they don't really want people to look at so much. Like, oh, yeah, there's 0080, but it's seriously one of the best single Gundam stories. Plus, it's 6 episodes long and very, very accessible.
Very digestible.
That said, I know that a lot of times when I try to show this to people, the second and the first episode, when the green Zaku emerges from the forest canopy, they all are like, not interested anymore. There's a robot. Sorry, guys. It's like, come on, give it a chance.
Yeah, I think that's ironic because of all the UC Gundam shows, I think this was probably the only one that didn't have mecha merchandising at the top of its list and could spend a little more time on story and character and put them in the front. The result was they didn't end up with a huge hierarchy of new robots to turn into model kits and toys. But in the long run, I don't think that matters because what keeps you going back to it is the story.
Okay. All right. Gundam 0080. Okay, Daryl, that means you're up next.
Number 7. My number 7 is Project Eiko.
Okay.
Pretty great movie that is perhaps best known in American fans because it used to run on the Sci-Fi Channel for quite a while. I know that was one of my earlier introductions to anime, but in terms of what this movie actually is, this is another one that's like the perfect result of the 80s Japanese economy bubble. The kind of thing that just wouldn't get made, not because it's artistic, but it's sort of the production of it was just another sort of animator's playhouse, as it were. Unlike Bobby's Girl, this is meant to be completely silly, which is an instance of the film that was completely overlooked by me. I just thought it was the coolest thing. But no, it's packed with all these in-jokes and gags and animators messing around in the background and that sort of thing. But yeah, at its heart, it's basically like a really great action story. Also, there's some elements of the weird space opera and like every crazy thing about, you know, 80s tropes sort of smashed together into one movie. And it's pretty hilarious if you know what they're talking about. In terms of animation, it's top rate stuff, action choreography, fantastic. I'm really glad it got a license rescue. It's in print right now, thanks to Discotech. Pretty cheesy, I'm not going to lie, but it's supposed to be. So that's one thing I'll put about it. The only warning I'll give regarding Project Eiko is don't watch any of the sequels because they tried to recapture the magic, and this is the sort of thing that a lot of the people involved in it, they were kind of only able to pull this one off once. And I think it was just the perfect storm of having the budget and the freedom and the talent all in one roof. And this is definitely one that stood the test of time for me.
Yeah, I think it was also one of the first self-referential anime films. And by that, I mean referencing its own medium and mining it for parody and humor. I'm not sure if there's anything prior to that we can point to except for the Daikon movies.
Was Prefectural Earth Defense Force afterwards or before? I want to say it was after.
It was the same year. Yeah, okay. They were both the same year, so I can't really tell. I love Aiko, but I'm too close to it. It's like, you know...
Yeah, you worked on it. You know,
so. Not only did I work on it, it was the first anime that I saw that I knew was anime. It was, you know, my fabled first tape from Blockbuster. So I can't step back far enough to actually know if it's good from a third-party perspective or not, because it's like it's part of who I am.
Hey, these are personal top 10 lists. I wouldn't let that stop me.
Yeah, fair enough.
It didn't make mine simply because I had to live with it for several months on end when I did the comic book adaptation, and that's all the Aiko I needed.
I didn't see it until last year, and that stuff, at that point, it is a parody of stuff that has basically been featured in anime only as a parody since, like, 1992. So it's, yeah, it's like, this is not funny.
Oh, I don't think it's particularly funny either. I just really like the film for what it is regardless. I'm not laughing at the movie as I watch it. I still think it's awesome.
To get the real magic of it, you had to see it within a year or two of it being made, because it's the kind of thing that as soon as you open Pandora's box, what it has to deliver is omnipresent.
Indeed. All right. Okay, so that brings us to my number seven. My number seven is Touch, the compilation movies 1, 2, and 3. It substantially went down substantially easier than Gundam did, considering they're only about an hour long and it's such a light story. Well, okay. Thematically, it's not a light story, but compared to Gundam, if you're talking about movie trilogies, Touch goes down easier.
Yes.
You're not choking on it.
I think that's another one where the compilation movies go down a lot easier than the TV show, just because the TV show is very glacially paced.
I asked Justin about this because Justin has talked at length about how much he loves this. And I always
shortly.
And I'm sure we will get to it again. But I always meant to see it. And I was like, oh man, I really want to watch Touch, but I don't have time to watch 100 episodes of anything. So thank God for these movies, which I really enjoyed. This is a really touching, really sweet story with really really great character writing. I mean, I think I'll let Justin talk about this one more, but I was really taken by the drama in this. And it felt organic. It's a little soapy, but it felt organic, especially the lead character, the jockish type that has this complicated relationship with his brother's girlfriend. And, you know, Justin can go into this a little bit more a little later on, but I was really taken by it, and I found myself really drawn into it. And I couldn't stop. I watched all three of these, one right after the other. I really wanted to see how it was going to conclude, and I'm not 100% certain that I totally loved the conclusion, but I feel like the conclusion was exactly the way it needed to be. I really like this a lot. I will say that who's the guy? Who's the artist? That
Mitsuru Adachi.
Yeah, his character designs
all look the same.
They all look the same, and they look fucking weird. It is not how you draw people. I don't know why he draws people like that. But that aside, it is very unique looking, and it totally screams 1980s from every pore.
Well, it's unique looking until you look at everything else Adachi's ever made.
Yeah, exactly.
That guy's the king of consistency. He's anchored down. He's not moving. And I think that's great. I still think his formula works. Have any of you guys seen Cross Game?
I've started to read it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, Mitsuru Adachi. Baseball involves, you know, slightly, you know, mostly about, you know, some sort of weird tragic romance, you know, as it were. But yeah, he's definitely a cool guy. And the thing that stood out to me about Touch, and this is another one where you had to have been there to see it then, it was the notion of this is a cartoon about something that you would never see, you know, traditional American animation be about, you know, at the time I saw this movie. And perhaps even now. I mean, it's not really a very merchandisable or action-packed sort of show. It's more or less just a straight drama. I'm sure a lot of people who watch it wonder, why isn't this live action? And I guess they got their answer to that a little later.
Yeah, well, I mean, and to it, like, the story is what sold it and made it one of the biggest hits in Japanese history. I mean, it's huge when it came out.
I have a question. One of the things that made the TV show so indelible is that the big, horrible, tragic turning point that we won't spoil happens right at the end of the first season. And, like, to the point that the last episode of that season ends with a Chiron at the bottom, touch part one, end.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do that again for the rest of the show. There is no part two end or part three end. And it just gives it such a turning point finality to it. I wonder where they placed that in the movie trilogy, because I hadn't seen it.
To my memory, it's at the end of the first movie.
Okay. But so kind of the same thing.
But then I realized, wow, this story idea has been ripped off by a lot of sports manga.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of that happening in sports manga.
Those jocks just can't catch a break, can
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they can't, man. They should stay out of traffic. but Touch was really cool. I'm really glad I got to see it. And I'm really thankful those movies exist, because otherwise I don't think I ever would have gotten to it. But that is a totally workable solution. If you're curious about this and you want to, the movies are... like I said, only about an hour and 10 minutes each.
They're not cut from the TV show. They're actually new animation. They look a lot nicer.
They look nice. Okay. Yeah, they do look nice. It's not like Gundam where...
Well, the third Gundam movie is new animation almost entirely. But yeah, I understand.
I don't think entirely. I think it's like maybe 60% new. But the DVDs that I watched for Gundam had the frame jitter thing so bad that it felt like somebody with ADD was like who had drank too much coffee was holding the camera. I mean, it had that frame jitter horrible through it. Touch did not have that issue because it was all theatrically produced animation. But yeah, super, super good stuff, man. I really dug it.
I get the feeling that won't be the last we hear from Gisaburo Sugi on these lists.
No. All no, right. It is not.
Yeah. Okay, so user lists. Chase Emery says Akira, Totoro, Macross. Vinny Av says Legend of the Galactic Heroes, Macross, and Akira. Anime Vision says Project Aiko, Totoro, Macross. You guys are seeing a pattern, maybe.
This is the first time Akira has come up in this conversation.
It has. It'll come up later.
Okay.
I'm at least glad that other people are mentioning it, because right now I'm like the odd man out as far as the Macross, you know, ardent support. But hey,
that's okay. Hey,
we'll keep going.
Represent, Daryl. Represent.
I will.
Okay,
I like
so
planes that explode.
We're ready to go to number six, and this time, Daryl, let's start with you.
All right, my number six is Urusei Yatsura. All of it, not just Beautiful Dreamer. This is a representative, maybe, of the works of not just Oshii, but Takahashi as well. I know you guys had a lot of Meizani Koku also rans and the like, but I think Urusei Yatsura is an incredibly imaginative show. I think a lot of people sort of either write off a lot of the TV in favor of only looking at A Beautiful Dreamer, which, don't get me wrong, is a masterpiece, in my opinion. Urusei Yatsura is Oshii back before he decided he never wanted to be funny ever again, which is unfortunate because there are two things Oshii's particularly good at, which is being funny and doing action scenes. And, you know, he's good at some other stuff too, but, you know, his post, you know, Pat Labor 2, he's basically been all serious business all the time. And this shows, you know, just how versatile a guy he was. You know, I always like to say that it was Urusei Yatsura that sort of laid down the foundations for a lot of those jokes for all those harem shows that I can't stand that came afterwards. But the thing is, when you go back and watch it, it's so much more than that. It's almost the anti-harem show. I mean, certainly when you look at so much modern anime, they've got, you know, a checklist of tropes and conventions, you know, Hot Springs episode, go to the beach, and so on and so forth. And certainly Urusei Yatsura had those too, but they had so much more than that because it was pulling from old Japanese myths and weird sci-fi tropes and ideas that you could get all kinds of crazy gags. I actually think that it was this anime more than anything else that sort of made the name Rumiko Takahashi famous, which is interesting because I tend to like the anime much more than the manga, which I know you tend to have much more exposure to than I, Zach. But yeah, Urusei Yatsura is insurmountably long. That's probably also why a lot of people overlook it. Yeah, it's very accessible because there's not really a continuity to it. It's very Simpsons-esque in that fashion. But yeah, I mean, this show deserves a second chance by a lot of people. A lot of people, when they think of the show, it's just Lum. It's just a girl in a bikini, a costume to wear at a convention because, what have you. But no, this is it's a funny show and it's pretty thoughtful. And as Oshii starts to make sure that no one's paying attention, some of those later TV episodes get pretty lyrical and weird on their own right. So, yeah, it's totally great.
The problem for me getting into Urusei Yatsura was always the first maybe 30 or 40 episodes, which have aged really not that great.
When you say episodes, do you mean stories? Because, I mean, the early episodes would have, like, two stories and sometimes be counted as two episodes. Or do you mean like a full 30-minute episode?
I think the whole part when it was two stories is
yeah.
kind of an issue. Because the story, they feel very 70s. They're very silly and cartoony, but not in a way that's really aged all that well.
But I think you're absolutely right. I think those early episodes, I think those are much more faithful to Rumiko Takahashi's vision of what these characters should be like and what some of these scenarios should play out as. I feel that there's a point where Oshii kind of sort of gets control and sort of changes the characterizations and emphasizes some of the characters that he sort of created just for the show or characterized uniquely just for the show. And that's really where it takes off for me. But I agree with you completely.
And I've heard that was the subject of many throwdown fights between the two.
Yep. And it's odd that once the change made, that seems to be when the show really skyrocketed in the popularity. And it shows in the budget. It shows in the music that they really went forth and put a lot of effort into getting audio and music and using that as a promotional tool. Certainly, Yamato paved the way for that. Don't get me wrong. But Urusei Yatsura it's odd that it's that forgotten. I mean, people still remember Ranma 1/2. Very few people seem to remember Urusei Yatsura. It might just be the difference between really not really having a dub other than a couple of first episodes.
Well, that and Viz was reprinting Ranma as of, 3-4 years ago. You can still buy that. They have not reprinted Lum comics in forever. It's not available.
I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage here. I never got into Urusei Yatsura for the worst reason, and that was that early in my collecting career, I ran into a whole bunch of psycho fans.
That was why I stayed away from Ranma. I'm on you. I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's unfortunate, but it's part of my past, and I can't let it go.
This was an also-ran for me. It was near the bottom of the list of also-rans. It's wildly up and down in terms of quality, like you guys were saying. But I think it is Takahashi's most successful romantic comedy in that it is actually funny from time to time. It actually has some funny jokes in it. Particularly, I've always thought the interaction between Ataru and the rich guy, Mendo, was pretty funny. Like, there's some good character moments in there. It was kind of funny. I can't say that for pretty much anything else she's made. Ranma 1/2 is sort of the opposite of funny. It's the same three jokes. Not that Lum doesn't recycle the jokes over and over and over again. Ranma's just particularly egregious when it comes to that. But it just seems like that. Then she took those ideas and remixed them for the rest of her life, I guess. And Lum was where it all started, and it's good. It's good. And yeah, Beautiful Dreamer, I think, is overrated.
Yeah, just I mean, the movies, too, there's certainly a lot of interesting experimentation going on in those films, and pretty much all of them, as far as I can tell, came out in the 80s, unless movie 6 was early 90s. I'm unwilling to check at the moment. But yeah, I mean, there's several other films that they just gave people money to do weird experimental stuff with, and they did it under the guise of Urusei Yatsura, this accessible sort of, blockbuster, quote-unquote, property. It wasn't, some under-the-radar production. And so I would encourage people to give it a shot.
And if not that, try Dr. Slump.
Right.
Dr. Slump is great. It's just a lot harder to get, but you can get the manga for that a lot easier.
Sure.
Okay, Tim, that's your number 6.
My number 6 is another TV series, also from Sunrise, the same studio that provided my number 7 and number 8. and this one is Giant Gorg. 26 episodes, 1984. It comes up a lot when you talk to collectors from the 80s. I'm not sure that it was really accessible, but for me, it was one of the first shows that I was able to get from end to end with no breaks. And I just love it. It's like Japan's answer to Johnny Quest. And it was directed and produced by Yasuhiko Yoshikazu, whose name has come up a few times already. And what makes it different from some of his other works is that I think his grip over the art direction and the animation was much tighter. Because when you watch the show, you could swear that he drew every single cell that you're looking at. Of course, it's impossible for any one human, so the next step you have to take is teaching a whole crew to draw exactly like you do. And he seemed to be a master at that, because every frame of film has his touch to it. And if you like his manga, then you will like this series. Story-wise, it's a very simple boys action adventure. And every episode ends with a cliffhanger. It's a lot like a movie serial. In fact, every episode ends with the same screen captions. Tune in to the next. Same Gorg time, same Gorg channel. And so they were shooting for a very specific type of entertainment, and they really nailed it. There is a giant robot in it, whose name is Giant Gorg, and then there are some other mecha things that come up later. And from beginning to end, you just don't want to put it down. Once you start it, you want to keep going. Unfortunately, it's never made it through the import gate over here. The only way you can get it, I think, is still by knowing somebody who knows somebody. It may have been fan-subbed at one point, but I still haven't seen it that way. But you don't really need fan-subs. The story is so simple and straightforward. You can pretty much follow it just watching it raw, and I've done so many times.
Yeah, we were this close to getting it here in the U.S. I remember there was a time when Bandai had announced that it was on the way, and that was really, you know, as a younger fan compared to the people who would have seen Giant Gorg back in the tape trading days, that was when I first started to hear the buzz about this particular show, that, oh, wow, this is this great show from back in the day that never made it out over here, and now everyone's going to get to see it. It never happened. I've only ever seen the show without subtitles, and I can confirm that, yeah, pretty simple to follow. I don't understand any Japanese, but it's a very visual story.
And apparently we were the only two who know about it.
Yes, yeah, looks like true.
I think basically Giant Gorg only comes up on the Ancast as a running gag, as far as like a thing mentioned by old people. So, you know, when I'm on with Mike Toole, we always like conspire to make sure Giant Gorg gets mentioned.
You know, this is one of those things that it's a little too little kiddish for me to really give a serious shake to at my advanced age.
That's entirely possible. I think it also depends on, as with many things, when you first saw it and the context of that. When I first saw it, I was just getting into Yasuhiko as an artist, and having 26 episodes all hewing very closely to his drawing style was exactly what I needed. It's exactly what I wanted to feast on at that given time. And so it has endeared itself to me and is a permanent member of my top 10.
Yeah, I'm curious about it, but the fact that it's so unavailable means I will probably never get to it unless somebody decides to make it available. So Justin, you're number six.
Okay, my number six is one that we actually talked about not so long ago on Ancast, just over the holidays. It's Windaria.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, wow.
I love Windaria. I love stories that make you lull you into a false sense of security and then punch you in the gut. In this case, it makes you think that it's a nice little, like, you know, fairy princess kind of, you know, antiquity, set in antiquity kind of, you know, stories of princesses and castles and shit. And then it's all like death and destruction and awful things and people doing terrible things to people they love and just leaves you with this sense of utter loss. I love that.
I think the reason that Windaria is not on my top 10 list is that was one that I first saw the streamlined version of it. And I know that's like the most legendary of the hack jobs as far as what got changed and what got taken out and edited out and so on and so forth. And I do own the DVD release. I believe ADV called it Once Upon a Time.
And which I is just that. Yeah.
And I think it is still that streamlined cut. I think the only uncut version of it I didn't see until many years later. And by then, you know, maybe the damage had been done in my head. It's like, oh, man, this thing's kind of whatever. But I think I do need to go give it a second shot. I mean, I always remember it as being better than what people said. But, you know, that's certainly a case where presentation counts for a lot.
Yeah.
I remember liking it quite a bit the first couple of times I saw it. I think it's one of those films that got to me within my first few years of collecting. And so, you know, everything from that time is special because I hadn't seen anything else like it. I also remember that I had gotten just deep enough into anime to recognize all of the voice actors as people I'd heard before in other shows, which kind of gave me a footing in at least that film that I'd never had with any previous anime that I'd seen. And I also quite like the soundtrack. I still have the LP for it.
You do?
Yeah.
We have to have lunch soon.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No, I appreciated Wendaria. It was definitely an experience. very over the top sadness in that movie. Lots of war is hell. Yeah. As a matter of fact, war is hell seems to be a running theme through a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, a lot of times it's appended to be like, war is hell, robots are cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't you want to buy the model kits? Yeah.
I guess this would have been the peak of the generation that either were kids during World War II or were like just growing up in the aftermath. So I guess, you know, timeline-wise, that makes sense.
Right. Okay. All right. So I guess that brings us to my number six. My number six is Riding Bean.
Nice.
Which I didn't think I was really going to have that much affection for, but I really did. It is a really fantastic 80s action movie that just happens to only be 45 minutes long. It's a classic, you know, nearly indestructible guy with a bandana on, dressed basically like Sylvester Stallone, looks a lot like Rambo, gets involved in a plot, kidnapping, and is basically sort of ambushed. The animation's really nice. It is probably the only Kenichi Sonoda thing that I am okay with, because I really hate his character designs, but wow. For some reason they don't bother me in this. It's just fun. It's fun from start to finish. The action's really solid. The story moves right along. It doesn't shit the bed or anything at any point. It's a solid.
It's got the coolest car.
Cool car. Cool hero that turns into Superman at the end of it. I mean, they established that he cannot be hurt by really anything. Even shot in you know, between the eyes at one point, and he basically shakes it off.
Yeah, this was actually the very first dubbed anime that I ever saw. Like, you know, there were two things that I saw as like my first like introduction, like, this is anime, here, check this thing out. And a guy gave me a tape with this and one other thing, which I'll talk about later. But yeah, I mean, I was blown away by it. I had like no idea of what I was in for. Like, very first thing you see, you know, you got like people getting their brains blown out and naked ladies and, you know, wow, I'm 13, this is cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it did drive me to seek out other stuff, and it wasn't until like years later I understood, like, oh, he has bulletproof clothes. That totally didn't like register in my mind. Like, the reason he survived the headshot was because she shot him in the bandana, his right. Bulletproof yeah. Bandana. And bulletproof bandana. Yeah, that phrase should kind of give you, the listening audience, an idea of what sort of mentality this film's going for. Totally set in Chicago, you know, the high mountains of Chicago. And I think that of all the Kenichi Sonata stuff, this is my favorite thing. Gunsmith Cats is related, and I do like the anime for that, but the manga kind of, you know, gets a little too skeevy for me after a point. I wish that the rights had worked out a little better such that they could continue making more of this. But, you know, there was a huge dispute over who owned what, and they never made any more Riding Bean beyond that point. And it's unfortunate, but the one we got is great.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the soundtrack by Phil Perry, a.k.a. the guy who sang the Goof Troop theme song.
Oh, wow.
Right, Daryl, I have to ask you a very important question.
Oh, boy.
Bean versus Geist. Who do you put your money on?
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to say if Geist doesn't have the assistance of his football suit, armor, and guns and stuff, that Bean Bandit's got the edge.
All right.
You know, I tried really hard to get into this show when I was younger, and it never clicked for me. I wonder...
You gotta like 80s action movies.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it is intentionally a little, like, over the top and cheesy, but I think the big part of it for me is this had one of those heinous Southwind dubs.
Oh, yeah. They just read the subtitle script and, God, that
and
dub.
It was so stiff and awkward. It took whatever excitement this had out with it. And I'm not sure that in my eyes, this OVA could ever recover from that. Because there's just not enough else going on other than the excitement.
Was it actually released under the title Roadbusters at one point?
Oh, right? No. Riding Bean is the only name I ever saw it as. I have the old VHS, like, hard clamshell case.
Okay, yeah, yeah. For some reason, I swear I heard a story about it being released as Roadbusters. Maybe
I believe this is a fan dub, a parody dub a guy made called Roadbusted.
Oh, I think that's
footage of Riding Bean and, you know, some guy running in at the beginning. Hey, I'm Carl Horn. Have you seen The Wings of Oniyamis? It's really great. You know, that was a joke back then.
Right. Yeah. Jeez. Old. We're old. But it is such an pure distilled 80s action movie. That is what it is. Although I will say, it does have a scene in it that really sucks, and that's the really awful moment when the villain has this, like, sidekick, like, little girl who they kidnap a dude, and she's, like, gonna blow him, and then she, like, runs in and, like, slaps her around and calls her a whore, and this scene's just, why is this even in here? Why does this always have to happen in anime?
Oh, yeah, and that was, like, one of Megumi Hayashibara's first roles in anime.
Yeah, it was.
See, I don't understand why this didn't wreck Riding Bean for you, and yet it wrecked Wings of Oniyamis.
Because it's very different, first of all. Wings of Oniyamis has the lead character forcing her down. He's going to rape her, and then she knocks him in the head and then apologizes to him the next day. That is worse than this.
I guess we've dispensed with the spoilers.
Yeah.
In this one, it's to illustrate how evil the bad guy is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is, yeah. That's
You're not
what
supposed
it's in
to root for the person who is committing the terrible act.
It's too much, but it doesn't wreck it. And I thought that myself. I was like, oh, am I being too hard on Oniyamas? Not hard enough on this. And I thought about it, and that's the conclusion I came to. But anyway, Riding Bean, if you can find it, it's cool. It's worth seeing. But if you like 80s action movies, like if you own Die Hard and Die Hard 2 on Blu-ray, probably watch this. Okay.
One more question for Daryl.
Yep.
Yes.
What if Geist has a knife?
Ooh. Well, now it gets interesting, Tim. You know, certainly a knife could, you know, do some damage to MD Geist, but, like, we've seen what he can do with that blade. He can, you know, cut off a guy's hands straight through bone, cause him to bleed sand blood. Yeah, you know, usually when I think of how Geist gets his most dangerous moniker, it's usually as a result of being shot into a satellite or, you know, blowing up a robot with has a smaller, tinier, more angry robot inside of it. I think Bean's got the muscle mass on a guy with his faux Duke Nukem character design.
All right.
But no, yeah, Bean is a super ubermensch. Dude, and my favorite parts of Gunsmith Cats are the parts where Bean shows up.
Yeah, I could never get into Gunsmith Cats.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a harder sell.
Yeah. All right, user lists for number 6. Our friend and yours, Ed Sizemore. Number 1, Totoro. Number 2, Nausicaa. Number 3, Robot Carnival. Our friend and yours, Brian Ruth. Number 1, Yuri Siatsura. Number 2, Macross. Number 3, Birth. Wow.
Planet Busters. Beautifully, there's been a real resurgence in people appreciating a Birth, to be honest. Like, never since Hiroyuki Imaishi and people have started getting into Gurren Lagann and all that stuff, and they're saying, oh, who influenced this guy? Oh, this dude Kaneda. Oh, this is his ultimate, you know, animator's exhibit, this thing. But as a film, I just cannot get into it. I mean, I'll respect it now, but I remember watching it, and that thing was torture to watch.
That's a rough ride. It's if you watch it for gags, you know, just grab any random 5 minutes. It's a lot of fun. But try and watch all those segments together. It's murder.
If you're curious to see Birth, go to any anime convention and hit the $4 to $5 DVD bins. They will have at least 2 copies of it. I think I'm at the point I have not seen a bargain bin that didn't have Birth in it in the last like 5 years or so, whenever they printed it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're like really big into this whole new appreciation of key animation, which I, you know, respect, I couldn't do it myself, but I respect those Sakuga folks. Yeah, this is your movie. But yeah, I can't put it on any top 10 or even as an also-ran.
Yep. All right. And last user list for this one, Clank, Clank, Clank has Onyamas, Legend of the Galactic Heroes, and Saint Seiya, which I thought started in the 70s, but I am wrong about that.
Yeah. That's for all like the people in South America and Europe and stuff. Saint Seiya is like one of the icons of the 80s. I think nobody in America really cares, just like how Fist of the North Star, nobody in America really cares because we just didn't get it the same time the rest of the world got it. Yeah. I mean, they still make Saint Seiya to this day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody here is into it, you know, so to speak, even though you'd think, you know, what with all the, you know, boys love yaoi type stuff that resulted and the change in the Shonen Jump action formula that occurred. You'd think it'd get a bit more of attention here, but no such luck.
Well, if you're relying on the boys love crowd, the characters in Saint Seiya are ugly as sin. So
listen, don't ask me to explain what goes through their minds. I'm just saying this is what they go for.
Personally, I think Saint Seiya always appealed more to the tokusatsu crowd.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the idea, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting that we never got more Pretty Boys in Armor type shows. We got that, Yoroid and Samurai Troopers, aka Ronin Warriors, and then Shirato, and then never again.
Yeah.
All three of those shows were popular. I don't get it.
And that's it for this time. You can hear the rest of our list, numbers 5 through 1, on the next episode. Big thanks to Daryl and Tim for coming on by. Theme song's Bucharest is by the band The New Division. You can find them at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a little note, a rating, or review. We would really appreciate it. We love you guys so much, and we will see you all next week with part 2.